tonight, Dr. Thomas Wayne ushers his wife Martha and small son Bruce through the gloom of Gotham's streets. They had come to the city to go to the movies, a family outing. Now they find themselves lost, caught in the shadows, trapped by the towering skyscrapers. Taking a wrong turn, they stumble into an area known as Crime Alley. Their story ends quickly. A man emerges from the shadows with a gun. He wants their money. He makes a grab for Martha's necklace. There is a scuffle and two shots ring out. Thomas and Martha lie dead. Bruce is alone. And so begins the story of Batman.
In February 1939, issue 27 of Detective Comics hit the newsstands, featuring the first appearance of a brand new character. By day, he was billionaire playboy Bruce Wayne, but by night, he was the Batman. 60 years later, he's still here, and this is his story.
They sometimes call him the Avenging Angel from Hell, although I suppose by the same token you could call him a demon from heaven.
He looks cool, he keeps you safe, or he makes you feel safe.
How many of you wouldn't really love to be Batman just for a night?
People say that these things are power fantasies or wish fulfillments. I mean, there is that aspect, but I think there's definitely more to it. I mean, it's primal. Nobody would necessarily want to be Batman. Nobody wants to have their parents shot dead in front of them and have to spend 15 years learning how to fight crime.
Bob Kane was 22 when he created Batman. Kane, who died last year, came up with the idea in answer to DC Comics' search for the next Superman. Kane's editor, Vin Sullivan, had snapped up Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster's Man of Steel a year earlier. That strip invented the concept of superheroes, and Kane, working with 21-year-old writer Bill Finger, set out to match its success. Batman was the complete opposite of Superman. He had no superpowers and, frankly, looked a bit of a nutcase. But the odd mix of ideas and images that Kane put together struck a chord, and Batman proved to be a massive hit with the readers. The six-page story, published in February 39 but with a May cover date, spawned an industry of books, movies, toys, clothing and TV shows and launched a cultural phenomenon and global icon. These days, you can even get a degree in Bat Studies. In fact, British student Will Booker is currently completing the world's first PhD in Batman and intends to publish his findings. He sees the Dark Knight's creation as a team effort and suggests that a good deal of nicking went on before Bruce Wayne's hooded alter ego made it as a comic book hero.
Well, the origins of the character seem to have been lost to some extent because Finger, as far as I can tell, never really had his say. Kane is, as far as I know, the only one who's published an autobiography. He's just recently died, of course. Finger died before that. So, I think Batman was probably more of a group creation than the common history makes out, because I think Kane has had a chance to tell his story and the others haven't. But Kane and Bill Finger were friends in New York. Kane went to Finger with sketches of a man in a bat costume, which Finger refined. As I remember, I think that Kane had him in a red suit without a full mask, a domino mask, which strikes me as interesting because he would look quite like Robin. Batman would have looked like Robin. Finger refined the suit. They went to a DC editor who accepted it. And I think after the first couple of stories, they had other people working on it. Batman, I maintain, is a very kind of canny combination of different influences himself, took kind of some of the most popular elements of pulp heroes at the time and combined them into a single figure. is that the play The Bat, which I think was made into a film, The Bat Whispers, and The Shadow as well, and all kind of pulp heroes of that period, and things like Dick Tracy as well, Dracula, of course, and Zorro, Douglas Fairbanks playing Zorro. And of course, he also says he copied it from, you know, his inspiration of the Batman from Leonardo da Vinci's sketch of a guy with bat wings. So there's a whole combination of different kind of pulp, popular influences.
In the early days, Batman was, quite frankly, not a nice guy. He looked scary, carried a gun, and people had a tendency to die around him. Just like Angela Lansbury in Murder, She Wrote, Batman was not a healthy person to hang around. These grim early stories are now seen as the purest incarnation of the character, but some experts disagree. Will Booker.
This mythical period of kind of Kane's early vision of the character, which people are always referring back to now, it was a very short period, but there was a period during which Batman was actually a grim gothic figure, and as I understand it, he was toned down because of complaints to DC's editors from parents, and there was some controversy at the time, as I've seen from researching the New York Times, about comics' effects on children. DC's editors apparently came down to Kane and Finger and said, tone down this guy, he can't use guns, we want his cowl kind of shorter over his face, and Robin was a result of that.
One of the world's biggest Bat fans is comic collector and author Duncan McAlpine. He's particularly fond of the early stories, and not just because he can make a lot of money from selling them.
My entire collection is something like 60,000 items. Difficult to say the total value. 600,000-800,000, I'm guessing. I think it's certainly the best collection in this country, and possibly one of the best in the world. The great majority of Batman stuff I have. I think I've got a complete run of Batman, and I also have the coveted Detective Comics number 27, the very first appearance of the Batman. It cost me £450. I blew my first term's grant on it. I was recently offered £60,000 for it, so not a bad business investment, I think. I'm told that there is a Detective 27 to come on the market in the summer. He's asking a cool £200,000 for it, and they'll probably get it too. Even though Detective Comics 27 had a May cover date, traditionally, they have something like a three-month leeway to give them some extra shelf life. So you could say that the last week of February is actually, chronologically, the 60th anniversary of Batman, and many happy returns.
Like all great success stories, Batman benefited from some happy circumstances and coincidences. For example, it just so happens that Kane and Company were heavily into the classic Orson Welles movie Citizen Kane, and mirrored many of the inventive camera angles in their comic. More importantly, one of the biggest effects on the strip was the clampdown on violence. It meant that Batman had to stop killing the bad guys, allowing the villains to keep coming back, so building up a catalogue of outlandish and popular bad guys.
Things you always wanted to know about Batman, but were afraid to ask. Number one, who's bad?
Riddle me this! If Batman's the hero, then why does everybody love the bad guys, the masked menaces, and super villains?
Did Killer Croc give you nightmares? Mr. Freeze, chill your blood. Well, if you flinch at the mention of the Mad Hatter, the Killer Moth, and fiendish foes like Clayface and Black Mask, then cover your ears, because this is the most terrifying top 10 imaginable, the rundown of Batman's 10 rottenest rogues. At 10, the man who broke the bat, the muscle-bound, venom-powered menace known as Bane. Swinging in at 9 and armed to his stitched teeth with fear gas, it's the Scarecrow. At 8, the centuries-old super criminal known as the Demon. And at 7, she's pretty as a daisy, but she's fungicidal and crazy. It's the poisonous Poison Ivy. Coming in at 6, like a cold front from Siberia, it's the chillin' Mr. Freeze. Waddling into the top 5 is that ornithological ogre, the Penguin. And at 4, the fearsome Two-Face, half good, half bad, all trouble. twisting his way towards you at number three is Mr. Edward Enigma, otherwise known as the Riddler. At number two, the sexy but savage Selena Kyle, the thief of hearts who goes by the name of Catwoman. And finally, at number one, the killer clown, the master of malevolent mirth, the one, the only, Joker. The 40s saw the first wave of Batmania. People couldn't get enough of the character, and DC launched a second comic called, not surprisingly, Batman. He also appeared in daily newspaper strips, there was a film serial, and you could buy bat trading cards, belt buckles, and toys. At this stage, though, he was still playing second fiddle to Superman, who was busy winning the Second World War. Bruce Wayne also did his bit for the war effort, but it was just that, a bit part.
Well, what I found as I approached my research on the 1940s was I expected that Batman would have been used quite a lot in propaganda. From reading Mark Cotta-Vaz's book, Tales of the Dark Knight, Batman's first 50 years, which was published obviously in 89, he reprints a lot of covers and select frames showing Batman fighting Nazis and Japanese and so on, throwing tennis balls at Hitler. But it was only when actually going through DC's archive that I had to come to terms with the fact that the frames and the covers I'd seen were actually just about every use of Batman for war purposes. I had to come to the conclusion that there was a certain amount of tokenism, that he had to be seen to be promoting the war effort, but that basically, as one of the most successful flagship characters for the company, editors allowed Batman to carry on his own sweet way, really, and not change that formula. And so there were kind of tokenistic elements where he would make a pose of giving rifles to a grunt on the front, or sell war bonds to kids and so on. In the actual stories inside, he did very little of that, and I think it carried on much as it had in 1940. I think the 1940s Batman stories have a very late 1920s, early 30s feel. They don't really reflect the 40s at all. Perhaps that's part of their success. I actually wonder if they're not quite comforting. Batman was read a lot by soldiers, just like other comics. A lot of its audience was, for comics, was then being shipped overseas to the front. So I do think, yeah, a kind of reassuring escapism that life goes on at home, well, as it did 15 years ago. You know, it's very, very safe. And the film serial of 1943 is actually in direct contrast to this, because that has Batman dealing with a Japanese scientist, which is really in no way an adaptation of the comics of the time, which didn't deal with that kind of issue at all.
I've got to satisfy a curiosity I've had for a long time.
Are you Jap devil?
I've got to find out who the Batman really is.
They represent American youth who love their country and are glad to fight for it. Wherever crime raises its ugly head,
come on, let's get out of here.
With the venom of a maddened rattlesnake, Batman and Robin strike also. And in this very hour, when the Axis criminals are spreading their evil over the world, even within our own land, Batman and Robin stand ready to fight them to the death.
During the late 40s and early 50s, Batman was to face a bigger threat to his safety than Hitler and the Joker combined. Psychiatrist Frederick Wortham, whose book The Seduction of the Innocent was published in 1954, became the figurehead of a concerted attack on comics. He displayed a particular distrust of the pointy-eared hero in black.
The Batman type of story helps to fixate homoerotic tendencies by suggesting the form of an adolescent with adult, or Ganymede Zeus, type of love relationship. Batman and Robin, the dynamic duo, also known as the daring duo, go into action wearing their special uniforms. They constantly rescue each other from violent attack and an unending series of enemies. Sometimes Batman ends up in bed and Robin is shown sitting next to him. At home, they live an idyllic life. They are Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson. Bruce is a socialite and Dick is Bruce's ward. They live in sumptuous quarters and have a butler called Alfred. Sometimes Batman is seen in a dressing gown. It's like a wish dream of two homosexuals living together.
Amen!
Critic Mark Kermode has his own thoughts on Wortham.
Wortham, he was very concerned about what people were getting from these comic books. And the thing that he's most famous, and I have to say widely ridiculed for, probably slightly unfairly, is that his analysis of Batman and Robin was that it was a very problematic thing because, to him, what Batman and Robin was really about was, a grown guy and a young boy running around in a cave wearing their pants outside their trousers. And he would indicate drawings in which you'd see the young Ward leaning slightly close to his, to his mentor, and he would see in this some terrible kind of sexual tension. Now, of course, the funny thing about it is, on one level, this was just completely ridiculous, and it was just somebody attempting to find, dangerous meanings in American comics. On the other hand, it is impossible to deny that there is something sexy and or sexual about Batman and Robin. I mean, it is, on one level, about a grown man and a lithe young athletic boy running around in a cave wearing their pants outside their trousers. I think to read it that boldly is to do it a disservice, but that was what Wortham was saying. I mean, this was in a midst of an analysis of a whole bunch of other things, like he had a problem with Superman because he thought that Superman was a kind of proto-fascist character. Again, it's easy to understand why he thought those things. So Frederick Wortham has become a character of ridicule, or I think unjustly so. I don't think the stuff he said was right, but he was just somebody flailing around attempting to find out what was wrong with comics, when the answer is nothing was wrong with comics.
The Good Doctor was not the only critic of the industry. Politicians, broadcasters, and any number of public-spirited Americans with their own agendas all jumped on the bandwagon.
This comic book is a love story. A boy and a girl in love. They get married, and after an offensively lurid description of their wedding night, illustrated, of course, the book shows how the bride murders her husband by chopping his head off with an axe. This comic book describes a sexual aberration so shocking that I can't even mention the scientific term on television. I think there ought to be a law against them.
At a time when nearly 150 million comics were being sold a month in America, the industry folded under the pressure and started cleaning up its act. Some titles didn't survive the purge. Others, like the Batman, were toned down even further.
I'm not a juvenile delinquent.
You can argue that the first attempt to tone down Batman came in the first 12 months of his existence, when Bob Kane and Bill Finger introduced the boy wonder himself, Robin.
It was an experiment. Kane and Finger went to the editor and said, let's try this thing. And they said, okay, we'll see how it works. And sales went up so much they kept him in. But it certainly lightened the tone, just as, his costume is so much brighter than Batman's. It completely changed the whole feeling of the strip. Kane says he based it on himself as a child, playing around the Bronx and so on. He makes out, tells these stories of kind of what a plucky youngster he was. But Kane also says he based Bruce Wayne on himself as a handsome man as well, a handsome young man. So, perhaps we've got this interesting situation where both Batman and Robin are based on aspects of the younger or the older Bob Kane.
Artist Jerry Robinson was 17 when he joined the Bat team. In 1989, in a BBC interview, he gave his version of the story.
Bill and Bob were already talking about adding a boy. The only thing that I added was the name, because they were thinking of various names like Mercury and some mythological names, and none kind of struck me. We had maybe 30 names, and I finally suggested Robin. I've been accused, because my name is Robinson, that it was they go with me, but that was not so. I was thinking of Robin Hood, and when we designed the costume, as you'll see, it's a variation of the classic Robin Hood costume.
Sales, already impressive, went through the roof with the appearance of Robin, the plucky youngster with a tale as tragic as that of his big bat brother.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I present for your delight and entertainment the fearless Flying Graysons, the finest trapeze artists in all of America. A real family affair, folks, with their young son Dick, the latest addition to their talented team.
Circuses can fall foul of the Gotham crime mobs, and even the brave can be taught a lesson in fear. All it takes is a sabotage guide rope, and the stars of the show end up another crime statistic in America's murder capital, leaving young Dick Grayson an orphan with a need for revenge, and Bruce Wayne with a kindred spirit to train in the ways of the night.
Purists, though, never warned to the small lad in improbable green shorts, and in 1988, a special phone number was set up to let readers decide whether or not Robin would perish at the end of the story. Predictably enough, the boy wonder bought it.
There came a point in Robin's history where, in fact, he got killed off. It was a very, very popular storyline, Death in the Family. DC Comics, in their wisdom, they had quite a good idea about setting up a kind of phone line, sort of hotline. Dial this number to kill him, this number to save him. Unfortunately, they didn't bank on the fact that there was one guy out there, I didn't meet him, who formed a society called the Twerpies, and their slogan was "Kill the Twerp," i.e. Robin, and he set his computer on this sort of constant redialing this number day in, day out, 24 hours a day, and registered tens of thousands of votes to kill the Twerp, and blow me down they did. They killed off what was actually the second incarnation of Robin then. But blow me down, in the tradition of comics, Robin returned in yet another form, so we're currently on Robin Mark 3 at the moment, and I'm sure there'll be a Mark 4 in the future.
British writer Alan Grant.
I suppose you could say in a way that it's interactive comics, but my line as a writer is that it's up to the writer to tell the story, and if you have to depend on your readership to tell you what the end of the story is going to be, then you've no business writing it. But like I say, it was a publicity stunt. It worked. It got massive coverage in America. They got hundreds of thousands of calls, but I think that they were wrong to ask the readers to vote on it. It's, you know, I don't think that you can vote on life like that, even in a comic book.
Things you always wanted to know about Batman but were afraid to ask, part two. The real Gotham? Or is it Gotham?
Everybody knows that the Batman patrols a fictional city loosely based on Manhattan called Gotham. But did you know that there's a real Gotham? And it's here, in Britain. Situated on the outskirts of Nottingham, this quaint old English village can boast four pubs, but is sadly lacking in supervillains. However, many centuries ago, it prided itself on being the loony capital of Britain. In the time of King John, the villagers hit on a cunning plan. If they pretended to be mad, they reasoned, the crown would think they were penniless, and so not worth taxing. With this in mind, they set about the serious business of acting completely cuckoo. They became famous for trying to steal the moon by fishing its reflection from the village pond, killing a cow after tethering it to the roof to eat the thatch, only to see it fall to its death. They tried to make it summer all year round by building a fence around a tree with a cuckoo's nest in it, and generally acted the goat wherever possible. The ruse worked. They got off tax-free, but landed the village with a reputation for lunacy. And when American novelist Washington Irving looked for a phrase to describe the madness of New Yorkers, he decided to use Gothamites, which soon became an American byword for battiness. One final point, I said the village was short on mad fiends intent on world domination, but there are two exceptions. Both George Bush and Bill Clinton can trace their ancestors back to good old Gotham. After attacks on his sexuality, the moral majority taking away his gun, and a proliferation of new sidekicks, including a magic elf called the Batmite and Ace the Bat-Hound, the next thing to dumb down the Batworld a further few notches was the 50s craze for all things sci-fi.
I think my favourite period, being a bit of a sci-fi fan, my favourite period of Batman really is that kind of 50s, we're not quite sure what's beyond the Earth's atmosphere type thing, are there cosmic rays, and for such an Earthbound character as Batman was, amazing how far Batman travelled out into orbit in his sort of, into his bat plane that suddenly became a sort of bat space plane, and beyond to sort of worlds with fuzzy pink aliens and twin blue suns, that kind of thing. So it really was a sci-fi madness, sort of Batman on Planet X type thing in the late 50s and early 60s, and that was my favourite period, I think.
Chip Kidd is the author of Batman Collected, an encyclopedia of every bat, toy and novelty item ever produced.
Every generation gets the Batman that it needs or wants. In the 50s, we needed him to combat aliens, which was the great metaphor for communists at that time. Actually, I'm working on a new book called Batman: The Complete History. I was researching it this past weekend, and we unearthed an ad from 1949 where Batman and Robin are driving down the road, and the Batman says, "I think I see, you know, a crime right there." And they run onto this little elementary school football field where a bunch of kids are playing football, and they're in an argument, and they are arguing whether or not to exclude this kid from playing with them because he's black. And, you know, Batman talks, you know, sense into them. It's all about, you know, you're not an American if you judge somebody by the color of his skin. And what other children's literature or even mass media was sending that message at that time?
Not even the Cold War's favourite bête noir, the Flying Saucer, could stop the slip in sales. Come the 60s, things were looking black for the Bat.
In the early 60s, the title really, the Batman comics were not selling. They were all about, you know, Batman chasing aliens and doing all this kind of ridiculous stuff. The original concept of the character had all but completely faded away, and the editor-in-chief Julius Schwartz said to Carmine Infantino, "Okay, I want you to make Batman over. We'll give it a year. If it doesn't work, if sales don't go up, I think that's the end of the title." Infantino made it more realistic, if you will, less stylized in the way that Sprang had been taking it, and brought it just one step into reality. It brought it more into the realm of illustration. He gave it more weight and more realism. And the major significant redesign of the costume that Carmine Infantino brought to it was Batman had always had a black bat on his chest. Infantino put a yellow circle around it and behind it. And now Batman had what Superman had had from the beginning with the S in the shield. He had a logo. After that, a yellow circle with a black bat in it could only stand for one thing, could only be Batman. I would credit Infantino with reviving it to the point where the TV show got made, and then after that, you know, the rest was history.
The good times were just around the corner. All they had to do was stay tuned. Same bat time, same bat channel.
To the Batmobile. Let's go. Atomic batteries to power. Turbines to speed.
The Batman TV series was a television phenomenon. Premiered in 1966, it was one of the first colour TV series and the first to go out twice a week, allowing each episode a thrilling cliffhanger ending. It was also, as one critic pointed out, one of the first shows where all the adults acted stupid. It couldn't fail. William Dozier was the producer of the show.
A very simple idea,
Spartland.
Very simple idea. Which was to so overdo it that it would be funny. And it would be exciting for kids on a daring do basis, and humorous for adults on a rather subtle, campy basis.
The humor meant that adults could enjoy it on one level while the kids saw it as a straight action adventure.
Well, I remember that one scene in the TV show where they're flying in the Batcopter and they lower the rope ladder and Batman climbs down the rope ladder and lands up to his hip in the water, and Batman's frantically telling him to raise it, and when he clears the water, it appears that there's an enormous shark attached to his leg. And at this point, I was just mortified. Robin looks into the cabin of the Batcopter and sees the bat shark repellent there, and he crawls down the ladder himself in order to give it to Batman, who just in time, apparently without the skin broken, sprays the shark, who then plummets to the surface of the ocean. And I was just awash with enormous relief at these circumstances, and my father, who was watching it with me at the time, was just convulsed in laughter, and I thought that was just hugely inappropriate and thoughtless on his part.
One man held the lunacy together, Batman himself, Adam West.
I guess it was my idea to do Batman that way, and as a matter of fact, during the shooting of the first show, I decided to play Batman in that way, and yet the writers and people kept firing wires back and forth from Spain to the studio, and what's he doing? He's not doing what we wanted him to do, what we thought it should be done. And I said, well, wait, just trust me. And evidently my instincts were pretty much on, because after that first segment, they did trust me and went with my interpretation. There was nothing to it. I mean, I just used the fact that my tights were itchy, that's all.
One moment in that first episode nailed their take on the Batman.
We had deliberately put one line in the pilot script that really was the key to whether or not this was going to be funny to adults. If you remember, Batman comes into a nightclub in his silly outfit, and the maitre d' comes up and he says, ringside table, Batman? And he said, no, I'll just sit over here. I wouldn't wish to appear conspicuous.
Adam became so famous that he was regularly mobbed. He was even given an audience with another Cape Crusader, the Pope.
It was difficult for me in meeting the Pope, in a way, because I didn't kiss his ring. And he was somewhat charmed, I think, though, by the American, because he said in Italian something that I didn't quite pick up on, and then like you used to wind up an old sort of gramophone, and the sound would get a little music, maybe fast. He started to talk to me in English, and he said, Signori West, I enjoy so much your Bat Show. I love to watch Batman in the Vatican.
Holy holy donut!
He admits that sometimes the madness of the show spilled over into reality.
Anybody who hasn't been through that kind of Bond, Beatles, and Batman mania that, you know, occurred in the 60s and 70s early, I don't think can really understand it. I was in England once, in London, and I followed Muhammad Ali into, Harrods, for an appearance. And there was a huge crowd. And I put on the costume and crawled out on a ledge above the street. I couldn't resist it. I mean, and started, you know, doing stupid things for the people down there, like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. And because, you know, you got to make it fun. And how many men out there listening, you know, you two or three guys, how many of you wouldn't really love to be Batman just for a night?